The clerk will call the docket.
Elisa C. Smith against Tammy Brown, Warden, Virginia Department of Corrections. Gregory R. Sheldon, City Council, R. R. Henry, Attorney General, Thomas D. Jefferson III, Senior Assistant Attorney General, City Council.
You may proceed.
May it please the court, my name is Gregory Sheldon, and I represent the appellant Elisa Smith. I would like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
All right.
I was appointed to represent Ms. Smith. She was convicted on a guilty plea of felony murder and distribution as an accommodation in the Danville Circuit Court. Subsequent to her pleas and the appellate process for a co-defendant, she filed a petition for writ of habeas corpus, which was denied, and that is the subject of her pro se appeal, which she's appealed here and which has been granted, obviously, today. The court is well aware of the standards, whether or not there was deficient performance, whether or not she suffered actual prejudice. And really, the issue boils down to what advice did she get, what advice was she given, and was the advice that she was given sound, and could she rely on it in order to make a voluntary and intelligent plea. And the court below found that she had, and the issues that I believe exist, they said that she failed to demonstrate she'd been misadvised, that the counsel was not required to predict a change in law, and that she had failed to allege any prejudice. Respectfully, she was convicted of second-degree murder, felony homicide. I think that in and of itself is sufficiently prejudicial. With respect to the predicting the change, that is an argument that the Attorney General refers to as the unsettled legal issue, the then uncertain defense with respect to the felony homicide and the res gestae rule. And respectfully, the cases that are cited in the Attorney General's brief in or opening brief, I think are supportive of Ms. Smith's position that had she known what the law was and had she been advised, she would have proceeded to trial. And I will get back to those. The question is whether or not...
Can I ask you a question about that last point?
Yes,
are you saying that the felony murder doctrine conceptually was clear, but its application to this fact pattern was unclear?
I believe that the doctrine was clear. The doctrine's been what it's been for, I think, Peacock is the first case that I found that addressed it. So time, place, causal connection. The issue in this case is time and place, as the Court of Appeals found.
But it's still a highly elastic test, if you want to call it that.
To the extent, and I think the issue is whether or not that conversation even happens. And if you, I think the what Ms. Smith has relied upon, rightfully so, is the letter that she's attached to her petition for a writ that's in the appendix that the attorney sends her and says, you've been charged with murder. No reference to felony murder, no reference to potential defenses. It doesn't appear in that letter. It starts off saying, I'm going to summarize our recent conversation. We've spent a lot of time talking about it. Goes into a discussion of accommodation and the co-defendant and how the co-defendant's a drug dealer and you're going to be judged based on his record, but does not get into any discussion with respect to murder. And the question is whether or not she's even been advised of that.
What would the advice be? There's a felony murder doctrine, res gestae has certain elastic prongs to its three-part test, and to be convicted, you'd have to be found beyond a reasonable doubt to have met each of the... why does that need to be said any more than what had already been said in the conversation?
Well, for starters, I don't know that we know what the conversation is other than what Ms. Smith has alleged.
That doesn't help you because you have the burden of proof.
I do, and the burden of proof here is met, I believe, by Ms. Smith saying, I was not advised in her petition. I was not advised that there is a potential defense here to this charge. And if I had been advised, I would have proceeded to trial. And the letter is written on, I believe, July the 5th and says, in that letter, it's my understanding you still intend to plead not guilty. And so give me the names of any witnesses, make an appointment. I think you should take this deal. And so we're talking about a couple weeks before, and then there's a plea shortly thereafter. And so the question here is whether she was even ever advised. And so I think it gets to the cases that you have, and if there had been this research, if there had been this discussion, and Ms. Smith says, I've never had this conversation with my attorney. He's never advised me of this potential defense that I have. You look through the Heacock case and the facts there. The defendant is at a party. He's a known drug dealer. He puts cocaine out for everybody. His argument is, well, I didn't pay anybody. Nobody paid me. I just put it out. I was just kind of accommodating everybody. It wasn't reasonably foreseeable that they would overdose. And so there they say, no, time. He's there. It's the same place. It's the causal connection that exists. The other case is...
So a reasonable lawyer could not have concluded that the benefits of the plea deal outweighed the possible win on res gestae?
At the end of the day, it's Ms. Smith's decision whether or not to enter a plea of guilty or not guilty. And her allegation, what she's saying is, I was not properly advised of what the law was. I never had this conversation, excuse me, with my attorney. He's never advised me of this potential defense. And had I known of that defense, I would have proceeded to trial. And the question is whether that was rational under the circumstances. The Attorney General points out that it was never pleaded with respect to the accommodation defense, and she's trying to leave that part of the plea agreement in effect. I bring that up in my brief solely to say I think he got it wrong with respect to the law as far as accommodation goes. And the Attorney General says, well, she'd clearly be convicted of distribution of drugs. I believe distribution of drugs is an accommodation. I think she had a viable defense.
The problem was accommodation is not in your petition for...
I understand that. I'm not saying there's an issue with respect to that. What I'm saying is, I think you have to view the advice given in totem. We can't say, well, what was the advice given on this charge and what was the advice given on this? Ms. Smith's allegation is that she was never advised of this potential defense, and had she been advised of that defense, she would have proceeded to trial. With respect to the accommodation, my argument is the letter that he has written that memorializes their meeting says you wouldn't be able to prevail on this accommodation defense because you have to prove it's for something other than to use the drug, which isn't what the law is. And the law is pretty clear. It was clear in Hecock. And so I bring that up simply to point out what is the total advice that has been given by this attorney to their client. And so I think just to kind of build on that, again, with Hecock, you get into the Hickman case that's cited there. The defendant and his cousin go purchase cocaine in Petersburg, get back in the car. The defendant or the appellant is preparing it on a mirror. His cousin uses it and dies. You have time, you have place, you have causal connection. The same with an unpublished case that the Commonwealth cites, distributes methadone to his two friends who then use it in his bathroom and overdose. There's a time, there's the place, there's the causal connection. Hilton, the same thing. Mother illegally purchases methadone, she pours it into a cup, goes into the next room, and her child consumes it. Time, place, and causal connection. Here you have the timing, which is at a Walmart parking lot. And then the use is after the victim leaves, after the victim goes out to dinner, after the victim goes home, after some period of time, she is then using the drugs later on in a place separate and apart from Walmart. And so while I understand, I don't believe that Woodard, while a very helpful case for Mr. Woodard, is as groundbreaking as the Attorney General or as the trial court found it to be. They've referred to it as an unsettled legal issue, as a then uncertain device. Now, then uncertain defense, and now it's a certain defense. But again, that the rule of res gestae has always been what it has, which is the time and the place and the causal connection. And so here, with respect to the letter, again, it advises her, and I think you have to view that as far as a summary of what their conversation was.
So can I interrupt you,
sir?
So if the attorney had said, you know, this murder concept requires there to be time, place, and causal connection, and it's an elastic test that applies to different circumstances in different ways. There's no case directly on point, but you need to know that's what's out there. Then everything would be different according to your argument.
If she had been advised, and that's the plea colloquy, is that confirmation by the trial court to say, have you been advised of any potential defenses? Have you discussed them? Is it your decision to plead guilty? And the idea behind that colloquy is to ensure that she has been advised of all of her rights, that she has been advised of any potential defenses, that she's discussed potential witnesses, to ensure that the lawyer has done all of his or her job.
She was a college graduate, is that right?
She is, Judge, but she's, or Justice, excuse me, she's not trained in the law. And so I think that the theory here for the Attorney General and for the trial court was, it's this uncertain defense. She's a high school graduate. She has a nursing degree. She can read and write. And she said she was guilty, so she must be guilty. But that is all based on the advice that she has been given. And to judge it based on the advice, we have to judge it through the lens of the advice that she's been given and the allegations that she's made in her petition, which is that she was never advised of any of this, and had she been advised of it, she would have proceeded to trial. And to suggest that, as the Attorney General does, to suggest that there isn't any prejudice because she would have been convicted because the co-defendant was convicted, I don't think is a fair thing to say as far as whether or not there's prejudice or not.
Can I ask you one last question?
Absolutely.
Does a trial judge have to believe her?
He doesn't have to believe
her. Every defendant who does a guilty plea could come back in theory and say, you know, they didn't mention Section 14.2 of Wharton's crim law, and if I'd have known that, I would have not pled guilty.
In this circumstance, you have, I think I can see an argument for a slippery slope as far as what could potentially happen and coming back at a later point in time. But in this circumstance, with the letter that purports to memorialize the conversation, which the trial court had, and my understanding is the trial court didn't accept an affidavit from the attorney. There was no testimony. There was no trial. This was dispensed with by order. Given those circumstances and given that letter in which he says you're charged with murder in violation of 18.2-32, which is not correct, and I don't know if that's a typographical error, but I have concern based on what my client has alleged in her petition as not saying felony murder, is not citing the correct code section. As based on his accommodation explanation, which I believe to be an incorrect statement of the law to her about what that is, based on his discussion not only in that letter but at the plea colloquy about being an accessory before the fact, which I think belies his understanding of what the law of felony murder is, and then based on his statement, you're going to be convicted of manslaughter. I think all of those things, I think that lends credence to her argument that she has not been advised of what the law is in this area. I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
All right. Good morning. May it please the Court, Donald Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth here. Justice Kelsey, let me take off for just a minute on that elasticity thing that you raised, because I think it is an important one when you evaluate this case. A lot of times when I look at these types of cases, particularly where I think the trial judge used the terms generous, lenient, some people use the term sweetheart deal, is on the table. 4 years active time when there's 80 years of exposure on the front end. One of the things that I do is sort of think, you know, what would I consider prudent if I were handling this? What would I tell the person? Because I think, and this is the type of advice I've given clients, whatever else you can say about this issue here, it's certainly speculative. It's certainly risky for the defendant. There's a huge downside to rejecting this. And whatever viable arguments that I might be able to make with respect to felony murder or accommodation, I may or may not be successful. I mean, the ultimate advice, obviously being geared toward what's in the client's best interest, not what the lawyer might think would be professionally rewarding or satisfying. Now, one of the things that I think that you need to look at here and would concern me if I were defending this person, again, even recognizing that Woodard's conviction was reversed, is I don't know that she's necessarily similarly situated, and I certainly think an objectively reasonable attorney could think so. And the reason that I say that is that unlike Woodard, the Court of Appeals opinion here emphasized that Woodard shook hands and then he was out of the equation completely. That's not really true of Smith. And I think that sort of cryptic reference to use in the attorney's letter, because frankly it made me cringe the first time I read it, I think read in context actually makes a whole lot of sense. Unlike Woodard, this defendant, and these facts are in the Woodard opinion and also contained in parts of Appendix 31 and 79. The transaction happens around 7. Sometime before 10 o'clock, which is when she ultimately leaves the victim's house, Smith goes to the victim's house and actually uses ecstasy with the victim. And I think that's an important fact because, again, to take off on Justice Kelsey's elasticity theme, I don't think it's necessarily objectively unreasonable to think that both the circuit courts and our appellate courts might think that you have, given that you've got a 3-hour time frame, admittedly it's not the same geographic place, but you're still in the city of Danville, it's close by, it's close in time, might think that that's a factual question with her, where you don't have that with respect to Woodard because he's basically ceased and desisted. So, I certainly think that's one issue that goes into the reasonableness of the attorney's advice. And again, I'm quoting I'm citing to Appendix 31 and 79 as well as the Woodard opinion itself. And to further tighten that time frame a little bit for you, the Woodard opinion actually makes clear that Smith's daughter, what happened in that intervening time between 7 and 10, Smith was out of the picture for a while, but Smith's daughter actually went to an Applebee's with the victim in this case for dinner in that interim time frame. And I don't know, I haven't had a chance to look at the pre-sentence report, but I know at least in the sentencing transcript there is a reference to a six-year-old daughter. I can't say for certain that that's the actual child. So I think as you draw those facts together, you've got a time frame there between the distribution itself, that perhaps the nexus is tight enough, at least that it would concern a reasonable attorney, particularly in light, again, as Justice Kelsey had said a few minutes ago, of the very good deal that was on the table. And I think that's important in your analysis. And I think also, if
an attorney... I've got a question for you.
Yes, sir.
Why do you say that was a good deal?
There was, well, first of all, I don't think you can factor out of this whatever she's convicted of, that there's a death in the case, and I think that's always potentially an aggravating factor.
What do you think the guidelines would be if she was convicted of distribution as an accommodation?
Distribution as an accommodation, I don't know. I haven't run guidelines. I know the maximum, Justice Goodwin, under statute is 10 years. I believe that came out in the colloquy. And
right, but if the guidelines say probation, no incarceration...
And they may well if it's first offense. I don't know.
Your deal, all that great a deal. You seem to think it was a great deal. I was just wondering if it really was.
Well, I think it's a very attractive deal in light of the sentencing exposure at issue. And remember, in this letter that's become such an issue, I mean, this lawyer clearly indicates to Ms. Smith that he's prepared to go to trial. He has a duty, I think, to give his candid advice. Now, would some of us have been quite so blunt about it? I don't know. I mean, I think you could make an argument that the attorney could be a little more standoffish with respect to the advice.
I don't think that's a problem. I think the question is the quality of the advice, not really how it was presented. You know, it's not that he was too blunt or he shouldn't have been as direct. It's kind of like, did he include enough information? Like, maybe this murder charge is not a very good one. And let me tell you why. You know, I think you have a good chance of prevailing. These are the things that the court is going to consider in deciding whether or not you're guilty of that.
Right.
So let's talk about that.
I think, you know, later on in the letter, and I'm not quoting verbatim about what's there, he certainly does talk about the downside risk. He's saying, I've recommended this to you. I don't know, particularly in light of the speculative nature of it, how much he really has to put out there on the table with respect to a potential defense to felony murder. He's indicated he's willing to go to trial. He's made a recommendation, and frankly, I think it would be foolhardy beyond words for an attorney who felt strongly about this not to make that recommendation.
But I guess the question is, why did he feel so strongly about it? I mean, he might have felt, it seems like to me you're saying he thought she was guilty of felony murder.
Well, I think...
And if you think she's guilty, 4 years is great. But if you're not sure she's guilty because of the fact scenario, then the calculus changes, doesn't it?
Well, I think partly in response to your calculus is, in response to the calculus here, is what's also going on with the accommodation. Is there really, are there concerns about whether this is really an accommodation defense, or is there a factual question on that? And I'd suggest to you on that, which if there's a factual issue with respect to the accommodation as opposed to as a matter of law, it goes away, that's a potential 40-year sentence right there. So I think over and above what you're dealing with the felony murder, you also have to look at that. And the reason that I say that, and again, going back to what a reasonable attorney could do as a takeaway from this, is the reason that I say that the accommodation defense may be risky in this case is because this wasn't just a favor to a friend, as it's been couched. Ms. Smith actually used drugs with the victim in this case within certainly less than 3 hours from the sale. And
well, the Commonwealth's attorney even said this was an accommodation.
I'm aware of that representation in the record, Your Honor, and this is what I would suggest to you. Obviously, in the course of proffering a plea, and I think, I mean, in response to Justice Goodwin's question, I think it's certainly rational for somebody to make the call that this is an accommodation. I think to say that the Commonwealth's attorney would have been so quick to conclude that I'm not going to pursue this as something other than an accommodation if the plea agreement were rejected is pretty speculative. You know, obviously, when you make a proffer to a trial court, at least the way a lot of prosecutors do it, they know the judge is going to want to believe that, or is going to want to be informed that there is a basis for the Commonwealth's attorney making that kind of reduction. And I think the Commonwealth's attorney certainly had a good faith basis for doing that. But I think where I need to back myself up on this is, you know, as the defense lawyer, what am I thinking? Among other things, what I'm thinking is, you know, I'm not sure if we turn this down that the Commonwealth's attorney is going to be willing to do anything other than to proceed to trial on the charges as they exist, including the distribution. And the case law that's out there on this, and because I do want to...
May I interrupt you for a moment?
Yes, sir.
Am I wrong, but I don't see accommodation in the advice regarding it in the petition at all, the habeas corpus petition?
No, the entirety of the claims, Justice Kelsey, I just reread it this morning, and it's very short, but I think I've got this right in explaining it to you. There's a claim that the advice was defective with respect to felony murder because my co-defendants was subsequently reversed. And then the second part of it is essentially that I was strong-armed and I would have otherwise entered a not guilty plea. So really,
so other than just, you know, curiosity as to other aspects of the case, is that accommodation issue even before us on a habeas petition?
No, it's not before you. I think, you know, certainly in response to the question that Justice Rausch asked, I think in terms of what's reasonable with respect to the attorney, I think Justice Goodwin had also put his finger on this, that you certainly have to consider what else was in front of the defense attorney and what he was facing at the time. So, I mean, obviously there was ultimately a plea to accommodation, but I would certainly suggest to you that prospectively going in as a defense lawyer, given the facts in this case, I certainly wouldn't think that we would necessarily prevail or that the Commonwealth attorney would be able to, as I said, anything other than proceed to trial on the distribution charge, which has a maximum sentence of 40 years. So,
your point is he just mentioned the accommodation to satisfy the court for purposes of accepting the plea.
Yes, and I don't mean I don't mean to suggest that anything was done improperly here.
No,
I think
the prosecutorial judgment.
It was an exercise of prosecutorial discretion. I think certainly most judges, when they take pleas, and sometimes there's actually an exchange with the circuit court judge, so the circuit court judge can satisfy him or herself that it isn't completely ridiculous to make the plea. And the argument, I'm certainly not disputing that there's some argument that she just accommodated a friend. You know, the Commonwealth attorney proffered that. And as you said, it's just a matter of discretion, ultimately. So in light of that, and I'll cite to this court's opinion in Stilwell, accommodation is limited to one who is motivated by a desire to accommodate a friend without any intent to profit or to induce or to encourage the use of drugs. That's Stilwell at 219 Virginia 214. It's a 1978 case from this court. And I think if I'm looking at this on the front end, whether this is correct or not, and again, remember that I'm just trying to figure out what would I consider a risk going into this case. And one of the risks that I would consider is that the Commonwealth's attorney is going to argue that, I mean, first of all, profit isn't necessarily money. She ends up, there's no indication in this record that she did anything other than use free drugs after she set up the transaction, first of all. And in terms of encouraging the use of drugs, obviously, she did them in tandem with the victim. And I certainly, to the extent that sounds like a stretch, because I'm going to throw another case at you, one of the things I'm thinking about is if I'm a defense attorney is I'm looking at that and I'm saying, you know, in Heacock, one of the issues that was raised in another opinion from this court is that essentially these were free samples, but ultimately Mr. Heacock was trying to facilitate, and this is a finding from this court, this is me making this up, ultimately what the defendant was trying to facilitate was his future drug for profit transactions. So I do think, Justice Kelsey picked the best word, elasticity. I think there's enough elasticity that vis-a-vis the very good offer that was made here, the advice was professionally reasonable under the circumstances.
Why is he telling her she's going to be convicted of manslaughter?
I'm not sure where that came from, Justice Rausch, and I don't think I can improve on what my former colleague did on brief on this. I think if you look in toto at the plea agreement and the colloquy, it's clear that she understood what she was pleading to, that she was, in fact, pleading to felony murder. And by the same token, I really can't explain the reference to 18.2-32. I think it was the erroneous one in the letter. I can't explain that. I don't know. I think opposing counsel may have speculated that there was some sort of perhaps deal on the table that disappeared or became moot or something, but I don't know the answer to that. He told her that in the letter, but ultimately, again, to come full circle, the plea agreement, the colloquy, everything indicates she understood what she was pleading to, and in fact, there are the exchanges in there where the attorney talks about how he's explained the felony murder doctrine to her, and, you know, again, ultimately...
That would be concerning to me as a trial judge. When the trial judge says, were you the one who made the decision to plead guilty? She's apparently, it's clear from the transcript, she's weeping throughout the colloquy, and her lawyer steps in to answer that question. And says she's having a lot of trouble with this. She's having a lot of trouble with this.
She clearly did have some trouble along the way, and she had some misgivings about it. I think ultimately, and at the end of it, she was given the opportunity to answer questions from the court. I do remember that, Justice Roush, and I'm sorry. I think there's probably some other questions that would be responsive to questions and answers that would be responsive to you, but I do remember that piece of it. I think if you look at it in toto, at least in terms of the issues we have in front of this court today, that should assuage any concerns you have about that. But
When I was a trial judge, I was always very concerned when the attorney started answering the questions in the plea colloquy.
I understand that. They obviously took a break. I obviously don't have an answer that's going to knock that one out of the park for you. It is concerning. I have really honestly forgotten that there was an aspect of that in the colloquy where perhaps defense counsel did. But I do think that you certainly have a significant, significant record here that it was adequate, professionally reasonable. The prejudice issue was addressed on brief. Unless the court has specific questions on that, I will say this, and I don't have any case authority to cite you to this. The active term has been fully served, and I don't know if that factors in as sort of a modified Hill. I'm sorry, I see my time's run out. I can finish in about 10 seconds if the court pleases. I don't know if it's sort of a modified Hill v. Lockhart situation, if that affects your analysis in this case, that essentially the active portion has been served, and obviously she's got some very difficult decisions to make if this is remanded in terms of whether it even makes sense to proceed. I'll tell you that at a minimum, I don't know the legal answer to that. I'll tell you at a minimum she's going to have an awfully strong colloquy if I have anything to do with it, because I'll ask the trial court to ask very pointed questions in that regard.
All right, your time has expired. Rebuttal?
And I just want to follow up. I had flipped, Justice Roush, to what you had just mentioned right before you asked that question. And the question is, after that discussion, did you decide for yourself to plead guilty? Yes. And the lawyer jumps in at that point in time. And when I read the transcript the first time, that was the most concerning thing to me in this transcript, because on that question, this has been, I told counsel I was going to speak momentarily to my client on that. It's been a very difficult situation because the case against my client in these charges involves concert of action and accessory before the fact. That's sometimes a difficult concept, and they go back and forth, and she says, but how the other ones can be very small in her behavior that puts her in the chain of distribution, that's been a real issue here, but she understands. And you've been over that with her? Yes. Okay. And then they start asking her more questions after that. And there's no conversation between to explain what her understanding is, and my concern and my point and bringing up the letter is, I don't know that the attorney understands, because the accessory before the fact, I don't know that you can be an accessory before the fact to an accident. And so here you have a situation where, an accessory before the fact is somebody who's not present at the scene of the crime, which the Attorney General is now saying she is present because she used drugs at a later point in time, and that's where the homicide would have happened, which then belies the felony murder concept because of time and place. And the city of Danville, I mean, time and place are specific. They are not these broad concepts in my estimation and my understanding of the law. But I have concerns that, A, this conversation hasn't happened because she says he's talking to her about concert of action and accessory before the fact and not the res judicata rule. And so, the question is, they point out what the ultimate advice is. Is it good advice? I don't think we can judge it to be good advice because there has to be a discussion of all the concepts. She has to understand what rights she's giving up. She has to understand why she is accepting this plea agreement. And Mr. Jeffries is right. I mean, there are times there's a pause, there's a lot of crying, they're offering her tissues, do you need a break? And they kind of plow through. But the statements even that the lawyer is making at the plea colloquy cause concern. As far as her using drugs later, the accommodation defense is one who is not a drug dealer. She is not a drug dealer. There's never been an allegation that she is. Who is not generally engaged in the distribution of drugs, who does a favor for a friend, not for profit. And so there is no argument, there has been no evidence that the pill is a result for I set this deal up. Because there are cases along those lines where somebody gets $5 out of it. Somebody gets a pill. Somebody gets a rock of cocaine. And that is not the evidence here. They were friends. They met back up later, some period of time, at a different place, several hours later. And that was not the evidence at trial. And the evidence at trial would have been primarily her statements and her cooperation. And so while the letter indicates that he's prepared to go to trial, my concerns are what advice he's giving her and what specifically he's telling her.
Let me ask you this. The way you frame, I think, your thematic argument, am I right that really what you want is an evidentiary hearing? You realize we're not going to be issuing a writ of habeas corpus based on our factual findings from paper.
I think it would be appropriate to have a factual hearing, and it was dispensed with, it was not done, and I think it would be. I think Ms. As I recall, Ms. Smith requested an evidentiary hearing, and I think it would be appropriate to go back.
I'm asking a harder question. Isn't that really the best you can do anyway?
Well, I don't know that it is. I think that, you know, the question here is whether it is twofold. One is, was there a deficient performance? I think that there is.
But we'd have to make facts. We'd have to figure out what actually the lawyer said that's not represented in that letter.
And so when the record comes to you, and so the question is, did the trial court err based on all of the information that it had in front of it? And so the trial court has reviewed this transcript, and you've now obviously reviewed the transcript, and you see the conversation, and respectfully, this is an inappropriate or incorrect statement of the law when he's talking about accessory before the fact to a homicide. And then you have the letter that he wrote, which miscites the law and makes incorrect statements about the law. And that's the evidence that the trial court had. And the trial court can only act, and you can only act based on the record that you have before you.
The evidence also is the colloquy, and that plays a huge role in habeas cases.
And the it does, and the evidence that you have is her allegation. And the question boils down to, is this good advice? And if she had gotten the right advice, would it have been rational for her to proceed to trial? And my argument is that it is, and that was her argument, and that's what she said when she filed her pro se petition.
But the assignment of error is that the trial court erred in not in dismissing this summarily, not granting a hearing.
That is how Ms. Smith framed it.
Right, and so if we agree with you, we'll send it back to the trial judge.
And I think there should be
a factual hearing, and let's chips fall where they may at that
point. I think that's appropriate. Thank you.
Thank you. Call the next case.